program that we put the patients through was to fast them for 4 days and then undertake food challenges for the next group of 4 days. We then tested them using a technique called provocation neutralization for foods for the rest of their stay of 12 days. Inhalant and chemical testing during the first 4 days was undertaken using the provocation neutralization technique. And then we would put the patient on a number of regimes, a rotation diet, vitamin and mineral supplements. We would give them counseling as to how to avoid the chemicals that they complained of being sensitive to, and give them instructions on their immunotherapy. The food challenges were a single food at each challenge. We would test their pulse and monitor other symptoms and document any observations. And after discharge, we'd follow them up at 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, and 1 year. Their symptoms would be reviewed and the response to treatment assessed. And the results showed that 8% didn't continue with their treatment. In 20%, there was no particular change noted. But there was an improvement in the general condition in 12% noted, and 60% were graded according to their, well, they were all graded according to their activities of daily living, but 60% were able to return to work or lead a normal social life following this program. Our observations are that, as with Dr. Ray, as he has noted, there are many foods, chemicals and inhalants which play a part in provoking symptoms in people who have a post-viral syndrome. And in the patients who came to us with a post-polio syndrome, in fact all of those returned to their former state that they had, their state of equilibrium before they had had the onset of new symptoms with weakness, fatigue and malaise. Thank you.
Jubelt, Northwestern. I want to make a comment first and have a couple questions. You said that a high percentage of those patients you found evidence of Coxsackie before infections. I don't think you can assume necessarily that those patients in which you didn't find evidence of infection had that same infection. I think it's well known that there are, at the same time, there may be multiple enteroviruses active in the community, so that it may be other enteroviruses that are causing the syndrome. Obviously, in addition, there can be other viruses, and at times, some of these patients may not even have a viral infection. So I think you have to keep that in mind. Then I had two questions for you. One, I didn't hear you comment about how long these symptoms persisted after the viral infection. I wanted to ask you to clarify that. And two, in terms of, along that same line, in terms of treatment, my impression is that these patients generally, the post-viral patients generally get better on their own over a period of time. So maybe you could comment on that.
Yes, well, the outbreaks of the epidemic virus infections had occurred some time before we actually saw the patients. So we had to go according to the history of what had been established in those individuals. The outbreaks were in the early 60s and in 78, and the Royal Free Disease was again in the early 60s. We were seeing the patients in the last, over the last 3 years. Their post-viral syndrome had actually been extant in many of these patients intermittently since their original illness, and had actually become much more severe before they presented to us. We weren't able to do any of the antibody viral titers for these patients. We'd had to rely on the documentation that had been done for them before. But in the Royal Free outbreak, it was an entire community of people who had actually suffered the same acute illness during the period of 6 months, and gave the name of the Royal Free Disease to this particular complaint. I take your point that we can't actually say that with these people who had the epidemic disease that they all had the same problem, though in some of them the Coxsackie B4 had actually been demonstrated to be a causative agent. Now, you asked what length of time the virus diseases continued. In the ones who had had infectious mononucleosis, the length of time varied between 10 years and 2 years. In general, we did not see them until their actual complaint had been persistent for about 2 years. They'd all been told it'll go with rest and so on, but in fact it was perpetuated, and in many of them it was also fluctuant. They would have a period of remission for a few weeks and then they would be unable to work again. And that was the pattern that we found in the majority of those patients.
Joe Crawford from Manitoba. Following on with that point about the variability over time, both you and the previous speaker have used the concept of using people as their own control, and you've measured them at a couple of points in time. But you've used general symptom checklists, the GHQ or the Cornell Medical Index. Any of those on a normal population will yield between a 45 and a 65% yes rate for some general kinds of symptoms like the ones that you've given. And when they're given to normal populations longitudinally, you'll find a variability of 15 to 20% in symptom reporting over a one-year period. And so it's very difficult using the kind of design that implies an individual as their own control to really attribute that to anything but the individual variability over that year that you've measured them.
Yes, I take your point, but the problem is that we're dealing with people with polysymptomatic complaints, and our major assessment was, in fact, the activities of daily living, and that is why we used a score of whether or not people were able to get about their ordinary activities, and in fact, the majority of the people who'd come to us had been unable to undertake their a normal day's work, whether it be housework or work out of the home. But in 60% of our people, they actually were able to be restored to full-time work for a considerable period towards the end of their treatment.
Ernie Johnson, Columbus. The thing that's missing in your protocol is any evaluation of their psyche. We were sitting over here listening to it, and it sounded like you were describing a depressed person to us. And that can happen. You can retrospectively look at a lot of different things that could be conceivably the cause. So if you don't select controls and evaluate the psyche, I don't see how you can say that the study has validity.
With our particular group of people, no, we didn't have a psychologist attending them, but I believe in Dr. Ray's unit, they do have psychiatric assessment, and perhaps he would be able to comment about that. I think that when you're trying to treat a group of people, because this was a treatment program rather than particularly designed with all the research data in mind, We found that certainly for treating these people, we were able to reverse their conditions in the majority of patients. And I think that shows that at least the treatment was effective, even if it was helping their psyche as well.
Bradley, I want to suggest a methodology which would bring together these two camps, because we all of us want to see our patients treated and improved. On the other hand, I think that most of us who have a scientific bent, and even those of us who really just would like to have an answer, want to be sure that what we're doing is right and has a basis. There is a modality by which you could use a double-blind controlled study of what you've now done, which is essentially a pilot uncontrolled study. And that's the sort of study that I think I would like to see presented here, is to take a group of your patients, choose what you would like to do for those patients, and then have a person blind the diet which was applied and the diet which was not applied, and have half of the group have what you thought they should have and half of the group what you thought they should not have, and then come and have yet a further person doing the evaluation. Now, if you could show statistically significant improvement in the group that you gave what you thought was the right thing, then I think we'd all be very much more convinced, and that is not beyond the bounds of possibility to do.
Thank you. I do agree that this is uncontrolled, and I would like very much to do some controlled studies.
Buchholz, two comments. One is that, to my knowledge, Royal Free Disease is a very controversial entity, and there's never been good proof that, in fact, that was a virally induced disorder. The other is that endogenous depression and depressive character disorders are extremely common, and the patients with them are somatically polysymptomatic. To echo Dr. Johnson's comments, these patients certainly could be depressed, and depression, at least endogenous depression, is a treatable disease with medication. I think it's extremely important to consider that as the cause of these patients' complaints rather than some post-viral syndrome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that this is an ideal workshop-type meeting for raising these questions, and I think the speakers are all taking under advisement the criticisms, and that's why I think it's very appropriate. We have two discussants now, and since we're in a form of a debate, our first rebuttal will be by Dr. Jonathan Brostoff.
I think to attempt to draw these strands together in terms of a discussant is virtually impossible. But I would like to make comments in a little bit as a summary. I will forswear classical allusions, but perhaps refer you to Henry VIII on his last wife. He had perhaps seen it all before, but how could I make it interesting for you? If I could start out with Dr. Holstead's clinical criteria of the post-polio syndrome, and I quote, fatigue, joint and muscle pain, weakness, muscle fatigability, and cold intolerance. These are exactly the symptoms that I and others see in the post-viral syndrome, which in general follows an acute episode suggestive of a virus illness. But in at least half the patients with exactly that clone of symptoms, there is no clear acute virus onset. There are a number of other symptoms in these patients that have been alluded to by Dr. Ray and Dr. Monroe, and the autonomic disturbance, the profound lethargy out of proportion to the way you see the patient as a doctor, and the water retention are quite characteristic in my mind. If I can make perhaps one point, that the water load studies that I have done in 23 patients with a post-viral syndrome show quite inappropriate ADH secretion in terms of water excretion with a standard 20 ml per kilo water load. When those patients have been worked up in a sense of removing allergens, quote unquote, their water load handling in 16 out of the 23 patients returned to normal. I could perhaps discuss that with you in terms of exorphin-like molecules altering ADH, but that is perhaps not germane to this issue. So we have a group of patients, and the points that Dr. Bradley has made and other people have made of, is it all placebo? Certainly it could be, but I think it's unlikely. We all have anecdotal patients, or post-viral syndrome patients that are ill. Girls that cannot go to school and have been at home for 9 months go through a regime and then are back at school forever. That is their well. They have been transformed. Of course it could be placebo. I think it's unlikely. Is this a typical endogenous depression? Out of the 23 patients that I have just finished working up, 23 had had a course of antidepressants and seen at least one psychiatrist, and often more. I should add that they'd often seen six specialist physicians of various sorts, and no obvious diagnosis been made, which is the cause of their referral to the psychiatrists. Full antidepressant treatment and psychotherapy did help a proportion, but certainly not as much as the sort of measures outlined by Dr. Ray and Dr. Munro. Now, this is all anecdote, but this is suggestive that it's not a primary endogenous depression. Now, there's no way in which I can say that the post-polio syndrome is identical to the post-viral syndrome that I see. You do not ask the questions that I ask, and I suspect I don't ask the questions that you ask. And until we have a common questionnaire looking at the sort of symptoms that I ask, and these have been alluded to by Dr. Ray and Dr. Munro, the arthralgia, the irritable bowel syndrome, parquet Dr. Patton, and I hope he never suffers from it, the migrainous headaches. These things are a parcel, and I think those of us that see the syndrome could recognize it in a bus queue, asking the right questions of the English people who queue so much better than the Americans. The other facets of this syndrome are the abnormal mentation. These people complain of fuzzy brains. They can't think properly. It is an amorphous collection of symptoms with no signs, with no abnormal tests, and that is intensely disturbing to the clinical scientists among you. And I hear Dr. Munsat say that unless you have, and others, that unless you have cast iron laboratory data, you can't make a diagnosis. Well, that is patent nonsense. And equal nonsense, if I can be slightly provocative, is to say that the post-polio syndrome must be limited to the effects on the lower motor neuron, as suggested by Dr. Munsat yesterday. The syndrome is defined by the patients. The patients define the syndrome by the symptoms that they complain of. Now, that is absolutely our duty as a doctor, to listen to the patient. And if we don't listen to the patient, we don't get the history, and if we don't ask the right questions, we don't get the right answers. Now, let me discuss, in view of the last two presentations and my, obviously, I hope, positively but prejudiced view, a concept of etiology of the post-polio syndrome and the post-viral syndrome. The short answer is, of course, I have no idea at all. But if the anecdotal data of Dr. Ray and Dr. Munro are to be believed, and it would be sad if you didn't believe the anecdotal data of Dr. Ray himself, clearly a well man now and clearly an ill man before, and the 17 patients that he has studied, we have to ask what insult to the system alters the function of that system to produce symptoms and not signs. And that is what we're talking about, a polysymptomatic syndrome with nothing much to find. And as I must emphasize, that is intensely upsetting to clinical scientists, but not at all upsetting to the pragmatic clinician. Do any of the post-polio syndrome patients have a preceding, and I put it in quotes, virus illness, purely separate from their polio? Can you ask if they have an environmental exposure to volatile chemicals? Those that are interested in the effect of chemicals on the brain will know Alkvist data, where exposure of rabbits on a rotometer shows that very low input of carbon tetrachloride into the rabbit produces such a profound nystagmus that is repeated on further rotation. And this is the quantity of carbon tetrachloride that you might get by walking into a dry cleaning shop and walking out again within 3 minutes. Benzene will produce exactly the same symptoms in the rabbit. That is a profound nystagmus. So we have the concept that it could be a secondary virus altering the patient, it could be an environmental toxin, and the comment from the front about is it a natural chemical in the food is of course of profound interest because of lectins, which can alter any phospholipid membrane, phenols, which are profound alterants of chemical structure, and of course once you alter the immunological status of the patient and the helper-suppressor ratios were abnormal, then a lot of other infectious agents may alter their ecology, either in the gut or in the systemic circulation. I refer particularly to the incidence of secondary autoantibodies in a proportion of these patients, and I call it secondary because I don't know whether it is primary or secondary, the incidence of antithyroglobulin, antimicrosomal, antiparietal cell antibodies is about 25% in our patients, which is considerably higher than an age-matched control population. We have an element of secondary candidiasis in our patients, I suspect partly due to the repeated courses of antibiotics, not necessarily due to their immunodeficiency. So we have now the problem of what is putting these patients at risk, and is it indeed a slowly progressive disease? It is a slowly progressive disease because you're not treating it. That is certainly a provocative statement. If, in fact, Dr. Ray and Dr. Munro are treating their patients and getting them better, then you are not doing the patient any good by at least not being clinical pragmatists. In a sense, to hell with the science. If you need a double-blind study, then it should be done in a clinical scientific institute. But if you have a patient that's going downhill, you owe that patient at least some therapeutic maneuver if other people have indeed shown benefit. The treatment is a problem because in the last 23 patients, we have two quite marked enzyme deficiencies. The first is phosphosulfotransferase P, which, as Dr. Spencer commented on naturally occurring plant compounds, phenols are endemic in the foods we eat as natural components, and an abnormality of phenylsulfotransferase may put the patients at risk from high loads of other phenylated compounds. We also have a very high incidence of cytochrome P450 abnormalities in our post-viral patients, and whether this is genetic or induced, I have no way of telling yet. But this would, the mixed oxidative function in the liver, also alters the handling of chemicals that we eat. The one serological factor that I think is of interest is the presence of persistent IgM complexes in a proportion of the patient. And if one disrupts the complex, the IgM is anti-Coxsackie B4. Now that suggests that in those that have the complex, they are secreting inappropriate quantities or qualities of virion protein. One of the things that has not been suggested here is DNA probes into muscle in those patients that suffer from myalgia and muscle pain to see if indeed there is abnormal genome products in the muscle. Now, this is such a simple technique to those that do it that surely this must be one of the avenues to be explored. I'd like to leave you with a concept that in no way have I summed up the problem of the post-viral syndrome, except to say that the patients that I see with the acute post-viral syndrome are similar in symptoms to the post-polio syndrome, and we must certainly reverse the concept that it is a slowly progressive disease. Thank you.
We're going to move on to our second discussant, who's Dr. Ben Park. We're going to give him 10 minutes to present both information and make an overview comment. If there's time for questions at the end, we'll try that. Otherwise, we'll continue it, I think, in an informal way during the course of the day.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being invited here. I am pediatrician by training and research in immunology. I was invited down to Dr. Ray's unit for evaluation of his study in immune function in his patients was in environmental unit. I saw remarkable change in the number of immunologic parameter. Therefore, I try to think about it, and I have been thinking about it for the past 10 years. Now, while I'm doing that, I thought that maybe our current approach or method of studying nature may have to be modified. So let me see the first slide. That is, if we want to avoid our mental inertia and try to stay away from academic stupidity and intellectual constipation, we must always re-examine our method and see if what we are doing is right for the question we are asking, and see if the nature can be interrogated by the method we are using. You see, we all know that there is a cause that is direct and sometimes indirect. And when cause is indirect, we are in trouble. And cause can be single, but it can be multiple. For example, you saw previous two presentations where a lot of multiple cause can be involved. And the effect can be early, which we like to see, so that we can have data point in a day, but sometimes late. Or the effect can be immediate or delayed, such as maybe 20, 30, 50 years later. The etiology, we all like to have a specific etiology, but to me, there are many instances where the effect can be cause can be non-specific. Again, the host response may dictate the phenomena we observe. That is, can be specific. We like to see one specific response so that we can analyze them. But in most instance, I believe our host can respond non-specifically. The outcome of these host and the etiologic agent's interaction can be decided on the virulence of the agents or host response, how the host responds. We all know that our immune system can change with time, with aging. Therefore, you get the virus here, the effect may be totally different when you get here or when you got here. That's the problem. So we can't lump up, as we like to see in inbred animal, that everyone is same. No, there's no way we can do that in this situation. And our body has multiple interaction. For example, this is one example I envision, that is, the immune system can be influenced by many, many factors. And this arrow is now reversed. It's two-way street all the way through. This complex situation is extremely difficult for our current methodologies to study. The environmental effect can be external. We like to see something outside our body, but can be also internal. Therefore, unless you know what internal environment is controlled, you really cannot decide what external environment can do. We can control pretty much over here, but we have not much control over here. Recent work in the immunology field, we are now seeing a complete interlocking between neuroendocrine system and immune system. That is, the immune system can produce these endocrine messengers. And this is not only conjecture, but it's proven by recent the gene probe that lymphocytes, splenic lymphocytes, do have the gene for coding for all of these material. And therefore, we have to think our way of studying the nature a little bit differently. That is, we are most likely dealing with many, many factors, maybe non-specific in many instances. So my final philosophical comment and conclusion is said by Confucius 2,500 years ago. What he says is that if you know how to cope with nature, you survive. But if you don't know, if you are working against nature, you perish. And this principle and this saying still apply to our current situation, especially what Dr. Ray mentioned. We are polluting all this environment, and we don't know how to cope with it. It's a self-destructive behavior which is common to all living organisms. Thank you.
We're now scheduled to have our break. And, does anybody have an overwhelming question they'd like to we're going to be switching directions, so maybe we can take an extra 2 or 3 minutes, if that's all right, and have the questions. And
Tubelt, Northwestern. I just had a comment and a question in terms of Dr. Brostoff's statements
about
treatment.
Why don't you come up and take
treatment.
A couple of questions here.
I think, you know, we all would like to be able to treat these patients and get them better. I think we'd all be happy if we could cure post-polio and the other post-viral syndromes. But I think we're all conditioned by the fact that numerous drugs and treatments have been used for other diseases that we've seen patients with, such as multiple sclerosis and ALS. And these drugs have been said to be very helpful, and patients have reported how much benefit they've gotten from them. But when finally a controlled study is done, they have shown not to be beneficial. So that's why we're all kind of hesitant to accept data that is not, at this point, well controlled. Now, then the question I had to ask you was, have EMG and muscle biopsy studies been done in the patients with the post-viral syndrome, and have they shown anything? And two, in terms of the IgM complex studies, have you had patients that had, say, Coxsackie B4 infections and didn't have a post-viral syndrome, and have they been looked at to see if they have immune complexes?
Well, I can answer the last question first. We're just embarking with James Mowbray at St. Mary's on these studies, so the clear control is those with Coxsackie that don't get it, but we'll only know that by long-term follow-up, of course. Your first question, your first statement or comment was, we give drugs to a lot of patients, and they're often not shown to be effective, hyperbaric oxygen recently in MS. I couldn't agree more. The difference between, if you like, an environmental approach and a pharmacologic approach is intrinsically the same. You want the solid data that the patients have improved. But the intrinsic difference is that we're removing causes from the patient and not treating symptoms. And I think that's really fundamental to the approach. If somebody's been exposed to high levels of toxic chemicals and you can remove them and they improve, and then you challenge them, albeit in a single blind manner, I agree, and their symptoms are provoked again, it is anecdotal data. And I'm not sure quite, if you wear your therapeutic hat, how much you can do except in an academic unit in investigating these people further. And that, of course, would be very good for you to do rather than somebody who has a busy clinical practice. And that's always the problem. It's not the problem in England, because most of the practicing physicians do at least have at least 60% of their time in hospital and 40% out. We have very few whole-time private practitioners compared with here. But many of the other comments on true double-blind challenges, perhaps I can comment on Dr. Bradley's question about double-blind foods. It's perfectly possible to do that. And Nestle's have just made up for us 20,000 tins, believe it or not, with a placebo puree base in one and the equivalent puree containing a meal-sized portion of egg, grain, and dairy. So we now have a double-blind, the possibility of doing a double-blind crossover with tins that they don't know what is, while they're either only having the tins or having basic foods as well. And it's a crucial thing to know. And I absolutely agree with you on that.
Peter Gow, Auckland. Having seen a lot of these patients, I'd like to make some comments on the comments. The profound nature of the symptomatology is so great that they're not the same people who'd fill in a routine checklist. And the psychological disorder that it's more likely to be confused with is not depression. I've done surveys and they're not depression's not a feature. It's more likely to be a somatization disorder. One of the problems with the treatment is it's the placebo value of whatever treatment is an important part of the therapy and often can't be separated from what you're doing. So your trial has to in some way include you know, the positive reassurance of placebo. And I think that most of the rationale for the post-viral syndrome can be explained on the basis of an autonomic imbalance or imbalance of the other systems, which Pearson has shown can cause all the symptomatology, really, that that these post-viral syndrome people can have.
Jasper gets the final word again.
This is not a question, but kind of a philosophical comment. I'm a bit biased, but I think the Mayo Clinic is one of the greatest medical institutions in the world. And at the Mayo Clinic, the pinnacle of intellectual capability, of course, resides in the neuroscientists who are at the Mayo Clinic.
Could I ask a question while you're saying that? You're not from that department, are you?
Yes, in fact, I am a neuroscientist at the Mayo Clinic. Now,
and are you on the pinnacle?
I'll let you decide that after I finish my comment.
I just wondered how sharp you found it.
Now, I think that you may be a little reluctant to listen to what I have to say because you keep interrupting. The Mayo Clinic has performed two interesting studies that I'd like to remind the group of. One was histamine desensitization of cluster headaches, which was a carefully controlled study which was very effective in treating patients with cluster headaches for a number of years. Another was the use of iontophoresis into the external ear for the treatment of torticollis, a treatment that was very effective in treating torticollis for a number of years at the Mayo Clinic. That was presented at a number of scientific organizations and symposia and meeting of this sort, and was presented with the point of view of, I'd like other people to do this because this is so successful. I think all of us, whenever we present our work, need to keep in mind that we as individual presenters are heavily tied up in our work, and we need to continually ask ourselves, how could I do this better? Where might I be wrong? Because even the pinnacle, that is the neuroscientists at the Mayo Clinic, have and will continue to make mistakes. And I think we need to realize that. Clearly, we want to treat the patients, and for the individual patient, it's fine. But if we want to tell other people this is an effective technique that you should use, we should be absolutely certain of ourselves and be willing to try other alternatives where we may be wrong.
Of course I accept that, and everybody who has a reasonable approach to medicine would. If, in fact, I accept the tenor of what has been spoken in the last day or so, the concept has been that this is a slowly progressive disease. If, in fact, there are some units or some doctors that show this is not so, then it is surely at the behest of those that show that it is a slowly progressive disease that are not treating the patients in that manner to test the manner in which the successful doctors do it.
We can all agree that it's coffee time.
Second session on Saturday morning. My own reflections of the earlier session resulted in my suggestion to Dr. Halstead that he should have placed that on Sunday morning rather than Saturday morning, but I guess that's all right to have a little philosophy. Okay, some people don't like controversy, but the sermons are best given on Sunday morning, at least in this country.
In this country, we need sermons every morning. That's the problem.
Well, we're down south here. This is the Bible Belt, in case you hadn't heard. So that was an entirely appropriate thing to start off with. Well, from the philosophic points of view to a more neurophysiologic view, we're going to start off our session on neurophysiologic studies with Don Sanders from Duke on quantitative electromyography and anterior horn cell disease.
I'd like to make it clear from the outset that the techniques that we'll be talking about during this presentation will be applicable only to the abnormality of the anterior horn cell. I have no techniques that will deal with irritable bowel or other such symptoms. And the question that we'll be addressing here is, how can these techniques help us to resolve the question of what is or is there such thing as progressive post-polio muscular atrophy? And we'll leave to the end perhaps the question as to whether this should be also referred to as progressive propter polio, progressive muscular atrophy. First slide, please. This is a list of some of the techniques that we'll be talking about, a wish list, if you will. Given world enough and time, perhaps, and very stoical patients, we could apply all of these techniques to the patients in seriatim to demonstrate whether or not there are changes in various attributes of the motor unit. A number of these techniques were discussed yesterday in Dr. Dalby's presentation, and I'll not, in the interest of time, I'll not review these, but we'll deal primarily with some physiologic techniques that were not mentioned yesterday, but that could perhaps shed light on these questions. On this list is not included motor unit counting, since I'm sure that subject will be very adequately dealt with in Dr. McComas' presentation next. First technique I'd like to talk about is that of interference pattern analysis, or as it's sometimes referred to, Turns analysis. This is a technique, or actually a number of techniques, which measure the signals produced in the muscle during varying degrees of muscle voluntary activation, usually recorded with a conventional concentric needle electrode. And the features of these signals that one pays attention to are the turns, that is, the points in the signal at which phase reversals occur. And we measure in these signals the amplitudes of the excursions between turns. We measure the number of turns per unit time. And we may refer these measurements to other parameters, such as the force level required to produce this level of activation. In a normal muscle, muscle is maximally activated here, we see a large number of turns and we see amplitude spikes which are larger than when we activate the muscle at lower levels. So by grading the degree of activation and assessing the number of turns and the amplitude of these turns, we can come up with values from control muscles against which we can compare similar measurements made in patients with disease. These slides are demonstrate results from a turns analysis system that we use in our laboratory, which I'll not go into other than for demonstration purposes.
This is the end of tape 7. Session 4 continues on tape 8.